This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents the Antaran Invaders series, book 3. Written by Vaughn Heppner, performed by Christian Rummel.
Chapter 1. Debbie and I were on the 18th floor of Hera's Hotel Tower in South Lake Tahoe when it happened. To be a little more specific, we were in Friday's Station Steak and Seafood Grill, with the best seat in the house right by the north window. Lake Tahoe looked beautiful from up here as the sun began its slow glide toward the mountains. I mashed my baked potato as Debbie divided our 16-ounce prime rib. Friday's Station always did the prime rib just right, so the meat melted in your mouth as you ate it. Seeing that the potato was fully dressed with sour cream, loads of butter, fresh chives, and real bacon bits, I added straight horseradish to my dish of creamy horseradish sauce. I was particular about my horseradish. I liked it when the condiment sent a sharp spike up against my nostrils and kissed my sinuses, but not so strong that my eyes watered uncontrollably. Debbie took her half, well, not half, more like one-third of the prime rib and handed the main plate to me with the rest. "Sure you have enough?" I asked.
"Oh, yes,"
she said. Debbie looked fantastic in her new red dress and black choker. Her hair was longer than when we had come back from the side dimension using the ancient chrono warp. We were doing better, too. Much better. It had taken time, but that time getting to know one another again had been well worth the effort. I kept in touch with the CAU, the counter-alien unit, but mostly Debbie and I had been cruising around underwater exploring. In case you don't know, I own a Galactic Guard ship, a glorified shuttle that I'd found in Greenland a few years ago. It could act like a sub, it could fly into space, and it had a matter transmitter, a teleporting device.
"Logan,"
said what looked like a metallic cell phone. The device was in the middle of the table. The metal was protective sheathing. Inside it was a crystal entity from Rax Prime. "I'm Logan, and I'd found the entity in the same underground Greenland complex where I'd gained the guard ship. Since the entity was from Rax, I called it Rax. Not too original, I know, but it worked well enough." "Keep it down," I told him. "Someone might hear you."
"This is vital,"
the entity said.
"Can it wait, Rax?"
Debbie asked.
"We're about to eat. I believe you should leave the premises. Immediately,"
Rax added. I'd forked my first piece of prime rib, brought it to my mouth, and closed my eyes as I chewed the meat. It was perfect, just like always. I loved coming to Friday's Station.
"Did you hear me?"
Rax asked. I opened my eyes and scanned the restaurant. We were on a lower level down here by the windows. The waiters and cocktail waitresses made their rounds. The hostess led a new couple to another table. The couple looked old, two dressed-up ancients with white hair. The man had trouble walking but refused his wife's help. "What do you sense?" I asked.
"It was a momentary flux,"
Rax said. "What does that even mean?" I asked. "What's a flux?"
"I am uncertain as to its exact nature yet,"
Rax said.
"It was as if something opened and closed, but in the blink of an eye. That is a correct idiom, yes?"
"Sure is," I said, cutting another piece of prime rib.
"Can you describe this flux a little more fully?"
Debbie asked. She hadn't started eating her prime rib yet. She also seemed more concerned about Rax's warning than I did. I was more used to his sudden pronouncements. Sometimes they were important, but at other times they had been false alarms because he'd sensed a solar flare on the sun or some other natural occurrence. "Double-check this flux," I suggested, already anticipating my next piece of prime rib. After this bite, I would try some of the baked potato.
"Did you not hear me?"
Rax asked.
"The flux was sudden. Then it was gone. At this point, it is not there for me to recheck."
"You recorded it, though, right?"
"Yes,"
Rax admitted.
"You have a point. I am analyzing." "Strange."
Rax might have said more, but I didn't hear it, as people around me and higher up in the restaurant started screaming. I looked up, even though my fork was halfway to my mouth. I swore a single harsh word as my hand froze. The cursing caused Debbie to twist around with fright. She gasped, no doubt seeing what I saw. Three hairy, I'll call them bipedal creatures. They had burst through the swinging kitchen door. They were big, with thick shoulders and wore harnesses around their furry, bear-like bodies. I don't think they were hominids like Philemon or Kaz had been. They were tall, each at least 6'5", and looked to be over 300 pounds apiece. Each wore a heavy pack on his back, and each cradled an ugly-looking carbine. The worst part was their faces. They were beastly, with protruding canine-like snouts. They almost seemed like wolfmen or werewolves, but there didn't seem to be anything supernatural or paranormal about them, especially with the blinking red lights on their extraterrestrial-looking weapons. "Get us out of here, Rax," I said in a low voice.
"I have already attempted a transfer," the crystal said. "Something is blocking my connection with the ship."
"Jamming?" I asked.
"Exactly,"
Rax said.
"It is powerful and from a non-Earth device."
"You're certain about that?"
"Not 100%,
Rax admitted.
"I would give it a 98% probability, though."
As you might have realized, I had emergency plans. As I said, I owned a Galactic Guard ship or shuttle. It was a one-of-a-kind alien vehicle. There were plenty of people on Earth who knew about it already, although it was hidden from the general populace and from most Earth governmental agencies. Among those that did know, probably all of them would have liked to get their hands on the alien ship. Most of those had tried in the past. I'm talking about kidnapping attempts upon Debbie and me, or acting like friends and then attacking me once we were all aboard the vessel. I'd implemented and refined emergency procedures that mainly involved Rax teleporting us back to the ship at the first sign of danger. As a secondary aside, I considered myself the premier enforcement arm of galactic law as regarded Earth. In this instance, that meant keeping Earth safe from marauding aliens. Earth was a kind of preserve, an off-limits, restricted planet. There were reasons for that, which I'll explain at the proper time. I'd found the guard ship. I'd also found a dead guard agent aboard it. His skeleton, to be more precise. In many ways, I was like an old West gunslinger who had found a dead marshal lying in the desert. I'd taken his star and pinned it to my vest. I was the new marshal in town, or the new Galactic Guard agent for good old planet Earth.
"What are they?"
Debbie whispered. "Trouble," I said. The screaming had intensified as everyone in the restaurant now saw them. The three beast men snarled. One of them raised his carbine. A shot rang out. A loud retort. Maybe a .357 Magnum? Instead of seeing a guest crumple to the floor, I saw a beast man's head explode in a spray of blood and bone. The big furry creature flopped backward, striking one of his companions as he went down. That caused the second creature to stumble as a line of laser fire, or some kind of beam, emitted from his carbine. That beam sliced against a wall, burning into it as nasty-smelling smoke billowed. Another shot rang out. The third beast man took a slug to the torso. He staggered backward. Another boom sounded, this slug tearing into his throat. That alien creature went down hard. The one emitting the beam finally got control of himself and his carbine. I saw the shooter then, a thick-chested man in a silky business suit. He indeed gripped a .357 with both hands. They were thick-fingered hands, not quite ordinary-looking, with massive wrists. Kaz the Neanderthal held the revolver. Ever since our last adventure, I'd wondered where Kaz had been hiding. Could it have been South Lake Tahoe all this time? I kind of doubted that. I suspected he'd been trailing me, again. "Down," Kaz commanded in his heavy voice. Then he unloaded the rest of his rounds into the chest of the last standing beast man. The creature went down like the others. Smoke curled from the barrel of Kaz's revolver. The screaming lessened some, but could still be heard from various parts of Friday's station. "Can you transfer now?" I asked Rax.
"Negative," Rax said. "The jamming is as strong as ever."
"Logan! Debbie!" Kaz shouted at us. People looked our way. I didn't like that. As surprising as it might seem at this juncture, I'd tried to keep a low profile in regard to the news. The Neanderthal flipped out the cylinder, dumping the spent shells from his .357. I heard the empty cartridges hit the floor. He shoved a speed round into the cylinder and snapped it shut. Kaz and I stared at each other. He had a mop of black hair, a low brow with a bony ridge, and an almost non-existent chin. He looked worried and determined.
"We have to get out of here," the Neanderthal said. "We have to leave before the rest of them show up."
Chapter 2. I snatched Rax off the table and stuffed him in a suit pocket. I was dressed up. Maybe not as fancily as Kaz or Debbie, but it was snazzier than my usual attire. Wouldn't you know that I'd forgotten my blaster in the guard ship? The piece was probably in my regular jacket. "Come on," I told Debbie. She was screaming wildly, staring at Kaz, at the spot where the beast men had been standing, and then around her at the people beginning to focus on us. I grabbed one of her hands and hauled her into motion. I used to be a U.S. Marine, so I knew how to get a move on when the moment called for it. After the Marines, I'd been a security officer for Western Sunlight, Inc. After that, I'd become the Galactic Guard affiliate, I kept in shape, in other words. Plus, I'd had alien gene therapy in the Greenland complex. That had left me stronger than normal, and with the ability to heal much faster than usual. The screaming was finally throttling down. Many of the people who had hit the deck on instinct now began looking up like frightened gophers peering out of their holes. Debbie stumbled behind me as I pulled her.
Faster! Kaz shouted at us.
The Neanderthal was rubbernecking everywhere, trying to watch the entire restaurant at once.
No!
Debbie said. She resisted me. I think she realized where I was headed and she did not want to go there. As far as I could tell, we were almost out of time. I yanked her, causing her to stumble into me.
Logan,
she said, sounding frightened.
This way, Kaz said, motioning to me. More are coming. We must leave.
I'd already figured out that much. It seemed obvious to me that the Beastmen had used teleportation to get there. If it wasn't exactly like guard ship transfer, it likely followed the same rules and procedures. I had a sense that whatever jammed Rax did so from the kitchen. If I wanted that jamming to stop, I had to get in there and shut it off. Debbie struggled harder now, but it didn't make any difference. Her feet stumbled across the floor as I dragged her toward the downed and likely dead Beastmen. I wanted to get my hands on one of those carbines.
Logan, Kaz shouted. Don't. Get over here.
I finally let go of Debbie's hand. People were starting to get out of their seats. Their brains must have been working again. They wanted to get the hell out of there, which was probably a reasonable desire. A wise desire, even. Several men jostled against me as they fled for the exit. One jock brought up his hands like a lineman and thrust against my chest, shoving me. That might have saved my life, because at that moment, three new Beastmen exploded out of the kitchen door. The first Beastman fired his carbine, sending a beam straight at me. The jock's shove moved me aside. The jock, who rushed forward in my absence, took the beam in his back. The green beam burned through his shirt and into his flesh, creating an almost instantaneous, nauseating stench. The screaming began anew. If anything, it was louder this time. Now people realized that aliens had appeared in their midst. A stampede began as people fled in earnest for the exits. I no longer saw Kaz. His single advantage, the element of surprise, was gone. Likely he had hit the deck. It was a wise move, as the Beastmen continued to beam the fleeing people. I dropped too. Twisting around on the floor, I saw Debbie lying farther away. She stared at me, shaking with fear. I began crawling, having to crawl over two dead people and one moaning, stricken woman. I still wanted one of those alien weapons. Then I would take care of these murdering savages. I had plans to launch off the floor at them from close range. I wasn't going to let them slaughter my girl. Harsh alien words sounded from up ahead. The whine of the beam weapon stopped instantly. The screaming had lessened as people had fled the restaurant, but I heard moaning, crying, and the sound of splintering wood as something crashed. I should have reacted faster. I should have sprinted to the dead Beastman and grabbed a carbine. I'd hesitated too long. Nasty surprises had a way of freezing a man's thoughts, but a reason wasn't an excuse, and it wasn't going to save our lives.
Logan,
Debbie whispered. I looked back at her. Debbie's gaze shifted higher and in front of me. I turned forward. A Beastman stepped into our lane. He aimed the carbine at me and snarled in an alien language. I stared into his eyes as a spotting light from his weapon no doubt centered on my forehead. I didn't understand a word of what he said, but I knew he meant we were supposed to surrender. That he didn't murder me right there was telling. Rax, I whispered.
The jamming,
the crystal said softly. I nodded to the Beastman, closed my eyes, and opened them again as I pushed my palms against the floor. With a grunt, I stood. As I did, I gave Debbie an extremely significant glance. It was clear that I meant she should play dead. They might get me. That didn't mean they had to get her. The problem was that Debbie stood as I did. What are you doing? I said. Debbie just stared at me with a hurt look. I faced the Beastman. Let her go, I said. He snarled in his ugly manner and waved his carbine, indicating a spot for Debbie to stand. What other choice did I have? I started down his lane, heading toward him. The Beastman snarled worse than before, raising the carbine to show he was about to fire. Clearly, he didn't want me coming any closer to him. I shrugged, climbed over some tables, chairs, and railing, and moved to an open area near the dead Beastmen. I was already envisioning lunging for a weapon, spinning, firing, and three additional Beastmen emerged from the swinging kitchen door. Their weapons came up, aimed at me. The Beastman that had caught me snarled to them. The new ones watched me with grave interest. One of them bared his fangs, slung his carbine over his shoulder, and produced what looked like handcuffs. I didn't like that. The other two new beastmen backed away as they kept their carbines centered on my chest. The handcuff bearer approached me, indicating that I should turn around. I did, but I didn't put my hands behind my back. "Rax," I whispered.
"I'm sorry, Logan,"
the crystal said in a soft voice.
"I'm trying to pierce the jamming, but simply lack the power."
Hot alien hands grabbed my wrists. The wolfman jerked my hands behind my back and clicked the handcuffs into place. This was just great. Debbie was finishing climbing down from the railing. She approached the beast man meekly, turned, and allowed the creep to handcuff her as well. Debbie looked up at me with tears in her eyes. "Don't sweat it, babe," I said. "They're not shooting us. That's a good sign." So far, the beast men hadn't attempted to capture anyone else. I didn't see any sign of Kaz. I don't know if he'd fled in the general exodus or if he was crawling around looking for an angle to play.
"Who are they?"
Debbie whispered. "No idea," I whispered back. The beast man who'd cuffed us turned me around. Debbie followed my example. We were both facing the kitchen door. I figured the beast man was going to push us in there. Instead, the door swung open again, and a tall, rather elegant man stepped through. He had refined features and a long face with a narrow prow of a hawk nose. He wore what seemed to be a metallic suit, had a holster at his side, and had short, thick hair like a pelt on the top of his narrow skull. As he approached, I amended my first impression. This fellow was not human, although he was clearly humanoid. His eyes were too dark, with an intense, burning quality. His skull a bit too long and narrow, and his lips just a mite too thin. He appeared supremely self-assured and must have stood a little over 7 feet tall. He stopped a few feet from me, unhooked a pistol-like device, aimed at my head, and pulled what looked like a trigger. Chapter 3. I expected to hit the deck dead. Instead, a strange vibration struck my brain. I felt momentarily disoriented. My eyesight blurred and a powerful nausea struck me. My legs weakened, causing me to drop to one knee. My stomach curdled, and finally I vomited up the little bit I'd eaten a few minutes ago. At least the horseradish didn't burn this time. Finally, the brain vibration stopped. My eyesight returned to normal. Strength flooded back and I stood up again.
"Do you understand me?"
the humanoid asked in a commanding way. "Yeah," I said.
"Excellent,"
he said, putting away, I don't know, was that a language gun? I realized I hadn't answered in English. I hadn't answered in any Earth tongue that I'd heard before. At the same time, I'd understood him perfectly.
"What is your name?"
he asked. "Henry Ford," I said, lying on the spot. He stared at me with his dark, burning eyes. I half expected him to come at me like a World War II Japanese occupation soldier. The way I'd heard it, the Japanese officers and general duty soldiers alike had been fond of slapping conquered peoples across the face. We studied each other for a span of 5 solid seconds. That might not seem like much, but try counting that out and then think of staring eye to eye at someone crazy for that long. The tall humanoid inhaled, and I had the distinct impression that he was restraining himself.
"You are ignorant, of course," he said. "That is to be expected from a denizen of this grotesque backwater world. Know, then, that you have the honor of addressing Lord Beran, a dominie of the Antares Institute. I have arrived to implement..."
He stroked his chin with a long index finger. A cruel smile stretched onto his face as if he just thought of something interesting.
"Do you wish me to use a mind probe on you, Henry Ford?"
"Is it painful?" I asked.
"Oh, quite. It will also leave you in an imbecilic state for many days."
"Then I decline your offer," I said.
"Not so ignorant after all," he said. "Perhaps you wish to amend your original answer before I am forced to implement harsher procedures regarding you."
I shrugged. He'd made his point. "Some people call me Logan," I said.
"Indeed. Are you referring to the Logan who considers himself a Galactic Guard affiliate?"
"How did he know that?"
"Your surprise betrays you," he said. "That is good, as that expedites matters."
He examined Debbie.
"She used to live in Far Butte, Nevada," he asked.
"How did this alien know so much about us?" Instead of answering him, my stubborn streak resumed. I had to figure out what was going on here.
"I'm that Debbie,"
Debbie said. Ah, excellent, excellent, he said while rubbing his long-fingered hands together. I glanced at Debbie. How had she understood him? Had the alien aimed his language gun at her while I'd been incapacitated? Take her to the transporter, Baran told a beast man. A beast man grabbed one of Debbie's elbows and propelled her toward the kitchen door. Just a minute, I said. What are you doing with her? Lord Baran of the Antares Institute cast me a burning gaze. I have read your file, he said coldly. You have several annoying mannerisms. This insulting tone you take with me. No, I will not permit it. Attach the training device. A new beast man stepped up with a steel collar. The brute put the cold metal around my neck, snapping it into place. This is an example, Baran told me as an odd look came over him. Debilitating pain jolted me from the collar. I crashed to my knees, unable to cry out as the agony seared through my body. Abruptly, the pain stopped. I panted with my head down.
What are you doing to him?
Debbie cried. I looked up in time to see the beast man with his hands on one of her elbows pushing her faster so she stumbled through the kitchen door and out of sight. You are my prisoner, God Affiliate Logan, Baran said in a brisk tone. My battle force have captured you in a Stage 1 raid. Official interrogation will follow soon enough. This is a transition period for you. However, even now, I will not tolerate disrespectful behavior directed toward my person. I am a dominee of the Institute. I recognize that you are still too ignorant to know what that means. That is why I gave you an instructive correction. You Terrans are a physical species well adapted to pain stimulations. Do not doubt that I will enact strict punishments for further misbehavior. I climbed back up to a standing position. I hated the smug bastard, but rage wasn't going to help me now. I was wearing handcuffs. A beast man was taking Debbie to a transporter. This Lord Baran knew far too much about us. I had a feeling he'd gotten this information from CAU. You are supposed to have a crystalline entity from Rex Prime, Baran said. Where is the crystal? I desire to appropriate it. Lord Baran, I said, trying to sound meek. May I ask why you're on Earth? No. Do you plan to attend my words carefully, Logan creature? Baran said, holding up a long-fingered hand, interrupting me. I will administer more pain if you continue to berate me with queries. I am the master here. You are the prisoner thrall. It is unseemly that you pepper me with these questions. I have demanded knowledge concerning the whereabouts of the Rax Prime crystal. Evasion means you are attempting more deception. This I will not tolerate.
I understand, Lord Baran.
No, you are still evading. I am not asking if you understand. Give me the whereabouts of the crystal. Do it at once.
I had a gut feeling then. Lord Baran of the Antares Institute seemed to know exactly what he was doing. Even so, he was an alien criminal who, according to galactic law, wasn't supposed to be here on Earth. There's a good rule about crime and criminals. Never let a criminal take you to the secondary scene of the crime. What that means is that if a van pulls up and a door opens, and a gunman points a gun at you and says, get in here, the right thing to do is to run like mad. The criminal has greater control at the secondary scene of the crime. He can tie you up and do exactly what he wants at his leisure then. It would be far better to take your chances running as he fires a gun at you out in public. Sure, you could take a bullet, but then he'd drive away and an ambulance could come and get you. The point was that I couldn't let Lord Baran grab Rax and transport us to his place of security. I had to do anything I could to stay free. The crystal is over there, Lord, I said, motioning with my head.
I desire greater precision as to the crystal's exact whereabouts, he said.
May I show you, Lord?
He stared at me with those burning eyes and finally nodded. Meekly, with my hands cuffed behind my back, I started toward the table where I'd been eating with Debbie.
A beast man followed. I looked back. Lord Baran was watching me impatiently. My heart began pounding. It could be that I was about to commit a crazy form of suicide. I didn't see any other way, though, and I had to remain free. I couldn't let this Baran win. The training device on my neck assured me of that. Besides, there's another rule I try to live by. Better to fight on your knees than to surrender. It was even better to fight on your feet, though. I staggered as my eyesight momentarily blurred. My heart was racing. The
There were so many things that could go wrong with my plan. Halt, Baran said. He knows, I told myself. Maybe I panicked. I don't know. I lowered my head and I began to run like a madman. Stop him, Baran shouted. The beast man behind me snarled, lunging to grab me. I dodged just enough so that the beast man crashed against a table. This is preposterous, Baran declared. Pain hit then, pain through the training collar around my neck. But I was ready for it this time. I'd been expecting the pain. It still hurt like a son of a gun, but I kept running as hard as I could. Logan, Baran shouted. This will cost you dearly. I ran full tilt at the north window of Friday's station. I knew it was likely a reinforced window, but this one had taken some beam shots and had already cracked. At that point, the pain intensified to what seemed like an intolerable level. I cried out, but I launched myself at the window. I hit with my right shoulder. Glass shattered, and I sailed out of the 18th floor of the Hera Hotel Tower. I jumped hard in order to pass the outer railing, and I'd succeeded. As the pain jolted me unmercifully, I began to plummet down toward the pavement 18 floors below. Chapter 4. I remember falling as the pain caused my muscles to tighten and then cramp at the agony. I thought someone called my name. I couldn't tell, though. Tears streaked down my eyes as I looked down. The ground rushed up at me with far too much speed. This wasn't going to work. This wasn't... The world vanished. Had I already hit? Was I dead? I didn't feel dead. The pain stopped then. A second later, I reappeared on the transfer dais aboard my guard ship. I sagged in relief. My wild gamble had paid off. By leaping from the 18th floor, I'd no doubt plummeted out of range of the jamming device that kept Rax from contacting the guard ship. Just what I'd been counting on. There were a few of you, I'm sure, who were wondering about my momentum from the fall. Shouldn't I have hit the transfer dais with the velocity I'd built up from plummeting from the top of Hera's hotel tower? In a word, no. The teleporting machine took the built-up velocity into account when it made the transfer and shed the momentum. Rax, I asked in a hoarse voice while I lay left cheek first on the dais.
That was incredibly foolish, the crystal said from my suit pocket.
It worked, didn't it?
Just barely, he said. You could have just as easily died.
Yeah, I said. I know. What other choice did I have, though?
Few to none, Rax admitted. Well, as you say, it worked. You must remove the handcuffs and take off that obscene collar.
Why isn't the collar shocking me anymore? I asked as I worked myself around so I could stand.
That dilemma is easily solved, Rax said. I have scanned it and found that the collar does not possess a power source. That power likely came from the same machine in the Friday Station kitchen, whatever inhibited my contact with the ship.
Oh.
I'm curious, Rax said. How did you know the radius of the jamming machine?
I had no idea.
You mean you gambled that the jamming signal did not reach as far as the first floor?
Either way, let's not worry about it. We have to get Debbie back.
Logan, I clearly cannot return to Hatter's until the jamming stops.
I get that. So let's get these cuffs and collar off and you'll drop me back into South Lake Tahoe. I can hoof it the rest of the way to Hera's.
We need reinforcements, Rax said. I suggest you call the director.
Rax meant the director of the CAU. I'd never learned the man's name, simply calling him director like everyone else did. I did some contortions on the dais, working my handcuffed hands around my butt and legs until my hands were in front of me. Examining the cuffs showed me there wasn't any place for a key. Likely an electric current in the correct sequence would do the trick. I didn't have time for that. Exiting the transfer chamber, I went to my cabin. I had a monofilament blade that could cut anything. I picked up the knife from my desk and carefully cut the cuffs off. A moment later, I very carefully inserted the blade between my neck and the collar, and the knife sheared through that as well. I tore off my suit jacket and shrugged on a leather jacket. I strapped on the monofilament blade, grabbed an alien blaster, and hurried back to the transfer dais. Ready? I asked.
Using the ship's sensors, I have detected that the jamming has ceased, Rax said.
Great. Put me in Friday's station.
I caution against such a hasty action.
Cut the crap, Rax. I'm going in. I have to rescue Debbie. At the very least, I have to figure out where this slave hunter took her.
Lord Baran could have laid a trap for you and be waiting for you to do exactly this.
That was a consideration, Haran had struck me as a crafty operator. The trouble was, I hardly knew anything about him. I thought about that. Do you know anything about this Antares Institute? I asked.
As it turns out, Rax said, a considerable amount.
Why haven't you said anything, then?
You were preoccupied. But this is the correct idea. Let us think through all the angles.
Transfer me, I said, getting worried about Debbie again. Rax never sighed, but he paused pointedly before saying,
I suggest that I remain behind. If you will take a comm device...
Forget it. I've wasted enough time. Transfer me, Rax. That's an order.
Wouldn't you like to learn about the Institute?
He asked, hedging. I would, but this is a time-sensitive operation. Now let's go.
As you wish,
he said. As I stood on the transfer dais, my molecules began to disassemble and convert to energy, so the machine could teleport me back to Hera's in South Lake Tahoe. Chapter 5. With blaster in hand, I appeared near the Friday Station kitchen door. I'd transferred while crouched low in order to present a smaller target. Immediately upon solidifying, I swiveled around, trying to see if anyone was going to ambush me. The place was eerily quiet. There were bodies on the floor, but no one moaned or cried out. I didn't like the burnt stench drifting through the restaurant. I looked around more carefully. No beastmen corpses lay on the floor, although I spied pools of blood where they had been lying. In a crouch, I hurried to various human bodies. Each of them was dead. Some of the wounds did not appear as if they should have killed the bearer. Did the beam have a deadly after effect? It seemed more than possible. Scan anything? I asked Rax.
I presume you mean of an alien nature,
the crystal said through its speaker. That's right.
Negative,
Rax said. Not even in the kitchen? I asked.
No.
I swore softly as I hurried to the kitchen. The cooks and assistants were all dead. Some salmon had badly burned on a grill. I saw no sign of Beastmen, Lord Baran, Debbie, or any alien transfer device. Isn't there anything we can use as a clue? I asked.
We could examine the beam burns, Rax suggested.
I stepped beside a cook, a fat man with a surprised look frozen on his dead features. Well, I asked.
The cells near the burns are all disrupted, Rax announced.
What does that mean?
That this was a highly advanced beam weapon. It did not simply destroy through intense heat like a laser. It also caused cellular disruption.
What does that tell you?
It confirms the idea that a dominee of the Antares Institute is behind the attack.
Tell me about the Antares Institute.
I suggest I do so at a different location. The local authorities are likely to arrive soon. We do not want to be here when they do.
You're right, I said. Answering police questions isn't going to rescue Debbie any faster. We have to call CAU.
I highly recommend that you allow me to remove us to the guard ship. We are facing extremely dangerous adversaries. We cannot afford a misstep.
Give me a minute for one more look around, I said.
I suggest you use speed, Logan.
I did. I scoured the kitchen, moved to the dining area and looked under tables, rechecked the dead, picked up several of Kaz's empty cartridges, and finally stood by the window where I'd jumped less than a half hour ago. It was hard to believe I'd really jumped. Just staring out of the broken window to the ground below gave me the heebie-jeebies. Take us back, I said quietly. Rax did not reply. Instead, I stood aboard the guard ship a moment later. Woodenly, as it sank in that I'd lost Debbie again, I walked out of the chamber and up the short hall and entered the piloting room. The ship was underwater by several feet, just enough to stay out of a curious observer's line of sight. We were about 100 miles west of San Francisco. I was a West Coast boy. Thus, I seemed to hang out in the western states more than anywhere else. There was a glass area showing me the green depths. I sat in the pilot's chair, pulled Rax from a pocket, and slotted him into the wireless socket on the dash. Let's hear it, I said. What is the Antares Institute?
It is situated on a planet in the Antares system, Rax said. It is a school of highly advanced study. The various dominees gather students and spend the majority of their time in contemplation and experimentation.
And they have slaves?
I believe thralls was the term, Rax said.
Same difference, I said.
Perhaps to your unstudied mind, Rax said. I doubt a dominee would see it that way.
Are you trying to piss me off?
In no way,
Rax said.
The scholars of the Antares Institute are proud of their achievements. Normally, they do not indulge in criminal activity. The Institute as a whole is neutral regarding politics and other social disagreements. The individual dominies, however, pursue their goals with great verve and at times ingenious cunning. If I were to guess...
Go ahead, I said.
It is my suspicion that Lord Beron is an archaeologist or some other type of scholar interested in ancient myths. Since he has illegally come to Earth, a restricted planet, I suspect he is interested in the Polarian legends as relates to Earth.
That's a pretty big leap of logic. Have you heard of Lord Beron before?
Not by name, but I believe by reputation.
You'd better explain that. Rex was silent for several seconds.
There were rumors among the guard about several dominies of the Institute inquiring too keenly regarding certain Polarian practices and antiquities.
Whoa, hold up, I said. What antiquities are these?
Logan, I'm about to inform you of a troubling problem. I hope you do not take this the wrong way.
That depends.
On what?
On what you're about to tell me, I said.
I feel it is important to remind you that you are a probationary affiliate guard member. Once a guard dreadnought arrives in the solar system, you will undergo strenuous interrogation, testing, and psych profiling. If you pass, you will undergo a short ceremony and become a fully affiliated guard member.
How about getting to the point? I asked.
I am afraid that you lack sufficient clearance to-
I'm gonna stop you right there, Rex. You do realize, don't you, that we're the only ones with guard equipment on Earth. The Dominies are here. Well, at least one of them is. Whatever Beron is trying to do is illegal, as you've already pointed out. Besides, his thralls have murdered people and kidnapped my girl. So you might as well tell me the whole shebang so I can uphold galactic law to the best of my ability.
Your logic is flawless,
Rex said sarcastically. I've met Argon, remember? Argon had been a Polarian. I've wielded a Polarian ring, an artifact. You've already told me that the process changed me somehow. If anyone has clearance to know what's going on, it's me.
I suppose you have a point,
Rex said.
Very well. I fear that Lord Beron may be attempting to locate ancient Polarian devices. As you know, some of these devices were, and likely still are, potent beyond normal conception. Legends hold that the Polarians were akin to gods in power, if not in judgment.
You mean like the chronowarp and the side dimension we found in the Bermuda Triangle? I asked.
And the star core, and other hidden devices far too powerful for finite beings to wield.
Including the Galactic Guard? I asked.
The Guard has placed the Earth off limits for a long time, Logan. No Guard member has ever attempted to search for these items. We protect galactic civilization. Certain devices are simply too powerful for any one being to use. One of your keenest minds coined a perfect phrase in this regard. Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Who said that?
A British noble named Lord Acton,
Rex said. You think Beron wants these hidden Polarian relics?
That would be my first guess. That does not make it so, but it would be a good place to start.
And this super-genius professor has beastly thralls to do his bidding, huh?
Why would that be surprising? An Antares Domini would not want to sully his hands committing mundane actions. What is more mundane and demeaning at times than fighting? Remember, the Dominis are proud of their intellectual achievements. They are men of the mind, or high scope. Thus, it makes perfect sense that a Domini would have beastly subspecies to do the grubby work for him.
How does Beron keep the beasts in line?
Isn't that obvious?
Rex asked.
He as good as told you when he explained to you that Terrans are a physical species. The Beastmen, as you call them, are also a physical species. Likely he uses a form of obedience collars on them as well.
What a bastard, I said. How do you think he knew so much about us?
That is a troubling question, but it indicates the kind of adversary that we're facing. An Antares Domini would come prepared. Lord Beron is clearly no exception to the rule.
Right, I said. It's time to call the CAU and find out the worst. Chapter 6. I sat in the pilot's chair, having swiveled to the side, so I faced the comm screen. I punched in the code for CAU headquarters, which was deep underground in the Utah Salt Flats. The CAU had secret offices in Washington, D.C. as well, but this was the heart of the American counter-alien unit. A second later, I found myself staring at the director, an older man in a black business suit. He didn't have a normal tie, but wore a bolo tie with a rhinestone at its center. He had shoeshine-colored eyebrows and was slightly overweight. He was a ruthless individual,
but we'd come to a live-and-let-live arrangement some time ago. Hello, Logan. I've been expecting your call. You heard about Beastmen aliens in South Lake Tahoe? I asked. He blinked at me. No. What Beastmen? I gave him a quick rundown about what had happened at Friday's station. The aliens have already made their move then, he said. This is worse than I expected. You knew about them? He shook his head. Not specifically, he said. Can you transfer me to your ship? I'm afraid this connection might be bugged. The Beastmen haven't attacked or tried to infiltrate CAU headquarters? I asked. He appeared to grow more alert as he studied me. No, he said. What makes you think they have? I drummed my fingers on the console and finally nodded. He was a suspicious director who seldom showed all his cards if he didn't have to. I decided to believe him. Are you ready? I asked. This is an emergency, the director said. Haste is critical. That was his way of saying yes. Right, I said. Rax, bring him over. As I watched the screen, the director of CAU disappeared. I got up and headed for the exit.
Logan,
Rax said. I grunted as my hand touched the latch to the exit hatch.
I just thought of something,
Rax said.
Why did the director himself answer your call? In my recollection, a secretary has always answered first, only patching you through to the director after some argumentation.
Rax had a point. I'd been an idiot. I drew my blaster and charged down the short hall into the transport chamber. I aimed the beamer as the director stepped off the transfer dais. Logan, he said, glancing at the blaster. This is unwarranted. I studied him. He looked like the director. He didn't quite have that haughty spirit of past encounters, though. He met my gaze frankly, waiting for me to arrive at whatever conclusion I would. That's what made me the most suspicious now that I viewed him face to face. Something is off with you, I said. I don't know what it is, but you're out of character. Care to tell me why that is? I would appreciate it if you would first put the gun away. Not bloody likely, I said. He squinted at me, rubbing his chin as he did. Finally, he sighed. I see we're gonna have to begin Plan B. It isn't as good as Plan A. I know you're not gonna like it, but... He shrugged and then raised his chin in a haughty manner. That made him seem more like the director I knew. Before you attempt any unwarranted actions, he began, I should warn you that I have a bomb attached to my person. If you doubt this, I suggest you have Rax analyze my body. That came out of left field. A bomb? I asked. I carry it due to the importance of my message, he said. In truth, this may be the most important message you have to hear. If you refuse to listen to me, I will detonate the bomb. And kill yourself? Get real. I don't buy that for a second. It is true, he said, trying to sound convincing. You absolutely must listen to what I have to say. I couldn't believe this. I'd never really liked the director. He was far too cold-blooded for my tastes. Usually that ruthlessness was just with other people's lives, not his own. Rax had already raised my suspicions. Now this bomb threat. I thrust the blaster into its holster, took three steps closer, and slugged him against the chin. The crack against my knuckles felt good. Even better was watching him crumple onto the floor where he hit the back of his head with a gratifying thump. So much for blowing himself up, if he even had a bomb. What an idiot. I knelt beside him and with a deft twist unbuttoned the black suit and then the white shirt underneath. All I saw was flabby pale skin. I frisked him but couldn't find anything remotely explosive. I did find a small flat device in a suit pocket. I took that. Then I sat back on my heels thinking. From on the floor, the director groaned and his eyelids fluttered. What just happened? He slurred. I waited. Gingerly, he touched his jaw where I'd hit him and jerked his hand away as if shocked. Slowly, he opened bloodshot eyes to regard me. I checked, I told him. There's no bomb. What? He slurred. You're not carrying a bomb. He just lay there. I guess he didn't like me having called his bluff. Finally, he dragged himself backward toward the dais, groaning when the top of his head struck the base. He slowly levered himself upright so he lay half-propped, staring at me with glazed eyes. Well, I asked. I do have a bomb, he said. Yeah? Where? He tapped his stomach. You swallowed it? I asked in disbelief. Yes, he said simply. "Why do that?" I asked. "While you were unconscious, I could have transferred you off my ship. Then what good would your bomb have done you?" A faint, rather sour grin touched his lips. "If you had done that," he said, "we both would have died." "That doesn't make sense." "If you attempt to transfer me, I will explode. We've studied the teleporting process, albeit from afar. CAU can't duplicate it yet, but we know what kind of T-waves your transfer machine uses. Don't you realize we're under alien attack? What's with this stupidity?" His features tightened, maybe in annoyance. "The trigger to setting the bomb was the first transfer onto your ship. After that, another beginning transfer..." The director spread his pudgy fingers as if to mimic an explosion. "Are you insane?" I asked. Despite the craziness of the idea, I was beginning to believe that the man had a bomb in his gut. "No, I am quite sane," he said. "The truth, Logan, is that we're desperate. The Earth is desperate. I understand very well about an alien assault. That's why we need your help." "For what?" I shouted. "You and I must head to Mars and set up a sensor array out there." "Mars? The aliens are already on Earth. Why would we need to set up a sensor array?" "I don't know about the aliens being on Earth," he said rather primly. "I already told you they were. Are. They appeared in Hera's Hotel Tower in South Lake Tahoe." "Maybe these are different aliens," he said. I rubbed my forehead. This wasn't making sense. The director having a bomb in his gut, more aliens out there, and Lord Baran of the Antares Institute having kidnapped Debbie. "Okay," I said. "Start from the beginning. Why do you want a sensor array in Mars orbit?" Chapter 7. Instead of telling me what was going on, the director continued to lie on the floor, first moving his jaw one way and then the other. Finally, he gathered saliva in his mouth, turned his head, and spit a bloody mess onto the deck. "Did you have to hit me so hard?" he complained. "You spit in my ship," I said, starting to get mad. "You'd better believe you're cleaning it up." He lowered the jaw-testing hand and gave me an incredulous stare. "What I have to tell you is a matter of human survival. I'm gonna start kicking you in the ribs if you don't get to the point." He slid farther upright, wincing as he did so. "Do you have any aspirin?" he asked. "Loads," I said. "I'd like 3. "Director, I'm not leaving you alone in here while I get you some aspirin. You want to get up, clean up your mess first, maybe I'll give you some aspirin afterward. Now about this line concerning Mars and aliens." "No," he said. "We must set up a sensor array. We must do it immediately." "Aren't you listening to me? The aliens are already here." He shook his head. "I'm talking about something much bigger than a kidnapping attempt." "What do you mean?" I asked suspiciously. "I'm talking about a full-scale invasion." Wait, I said, once more rubbing my forehead. "You want a sensor array around Mars. Why doesn't CAU ask NASA to place the array there?" "CAU's space vehicle is far superior to NASA's," he said proudly. CAU had confiscated some of Hap's equipment. Hap had been a monkey-like alien from the Chronowarp episode. He had managed to get himself killed 13 months ago. "If your vehicle is so good," I said, "use it to set up the sensor array." "Alas, while our vehicle is superior, it lacks true deep space capability." The director was starting to frustrate me. There was definitely something wrong with his thinking. "So which is it?" I snapped. "NASA can fire a rocket to Mars. Apparently CAU can't. That makes them superior to you." He sighed as if annoyed, pushed himself up to a seated position, and rummaged in a suit pocket. "Looking for this?" I asked, holding up the flat device I'd taken from him. "Yes," he said, holding out a hand. "Oh no. Forget it. For all I know, it's the bomb's detonator. If that's even legitimate. Rax can tell you what it is." I re-examined the director. I finally noticed that beads of sweat prickled at his hairline. Was he nervous because he really had a bomb in his stomach, or was it something else? "Suppose I believe you," I said, "that you wanted to come aboard with a bomb, that you want me to help CAU. Why do you personally want to go into deep space? You're the director." I stopped talking because his lower lip had started quivering. It was exactly like a small boy trying not to cry after being spanked. Was this all an elaborate trick that involved Lord Baran? I stepped near. He cringed and held up his hands. I slapped them out of the way, grabbed the back of his suit, and hauled him to his feet. I propelled him out of the transfer chamber, down the short corridor, and into the piloting chamber. "Rax," I said, "use your sensors. Is the director carrying a bomb in his gut?"
"Affirmative," the crystal said.
That loosened my hold of the man's collar. I let go altogether a second later. The director practically collapsed onto a panel, where he panted, took out a handkerchief, and blotted his now obviously sweaty features. It was an unusual performance for him, even more unusual than his having answered my call himself. Stuffing the hanky into a side pocket, he looked up at me. His lower lip quivered again, but he stilled it as if with stern resolve.
That is to say, the CAU have located strange radio transmissions originating from Saturn.
You're talking about aliens parked in Saturn's rings? I asked.
Possibly. In any case, that's what you and I need to determine.
You keep saying you. I don't want you on my ship any longer than necessary. I sure don't want to go to Mars with you. He patted his stomach.
I realize this, and that is why I have the Persuader.
Are you sure there's really a bomb in his gut? I asked Rax.
A double helix cobalt bomb, the crystal said. It is more than adequate to demolish the guard ship, which would destroy the both of us as well.
I silently mouthed double helix cobalt bomb before turning to the director. That doesn't sound like Earth tech, I said.
It isn't, the director said. CAU personnel found it in Hap's space plane.
Let me get this straight, I said. You want to set up advanced sensors in Mars orbit.
Beyond Mars orbit, he said.
Even if I thought that was a good idea, I said, I haven't been past the moon in this ship. What makes you think the guard ship can reach Mars?
We know it can from previous comments from Rax. The guard dreadnought was in Jupiter orbit before it left the solar system.
My guard shuttle once traveled from Jupiter to Earth? I asked.
Yes, Rex and the director said in unison.
I still don't know why you need my help, I said.
Because you control the guard ship, the director said.
Look, this is starting to get ridiculous. I would appreciate it if you returned my property, he said, holding out a hand.
I need the device you confiscated. I need it in order to keep the bomb from prematurely igniting.
I tried to mesh the appearance of Lord Baran and his beastmen with the director's knowledge of alien comm transmissions from Saturn. As I did this, the director continued to sweat. He seemed to reach a conclusion, and his features tightened considerably. He stood up from his seated position and suddenly lunged at me, diving at my legs. Kaz and Philemon had jumped me once on the guard ship. Ever since, I'd been antsy about a repeat of that. Unfortunately for the director, he was moving a little too wobbly for a good surprise attack. I rammed my right knee up, maybe giving it extra power because of my experiences. The bony protrusion of my knee caught the director square in the face. That made an ugly thump, and the blow catapulted the director's head back so his neck bones snapped. He half flipped and landed, crumpled, onto his back. The director just lay there. He didn't pant. He didn't moan. He couldn't. He appeared to be stone-cold dead.
Chapter 8.
I didn't mean to kill him, I said, which was the truth. I mean, I disliked the man. I even often said I hated him, and Debbie would chide me about that. She didn't like the word used casually. It was easy for me to say I hated something. That didn't mean I necessarily wanted to kill it. I hadn't meant to do that just now. I'd simply been protecting myself from a ship takeover.
If you didn't mean to kill him, Rax said, then why did you ram your knee into his face so forcefully?
That was reflex, I said. Adrenaline. He was coming at me. Remember how Kaz and Philemon took over the ship a year ago?
Indeed I do,
Rax said.
Their plan was well executed.
Yeah, whatever, I said. Their stealing the ship caused all sorts of problems. I don't know how many times I've told myself I'm never going to let that happen again. So when the director charged me...
You killed him.
I didn't mean to kill him. That's what I'm trying to tell you. I just wanted to knock him out.
There is a fallacy here,
Rax said. Listen, I said, starting to get mad.
I do not refer to your killing blow as the fallacy.
What are you talking about, then?
The director, the pseudo-director, I now believe, has a small device located in his cortex.
You mean in addition to the double helix cobalt bomb in his gut?
Correct,
Rax said.
I blinked several times as I ingested that. Do you mean it's a control device, like Sergei's clones used to have in their brains? I asked.
Clones, Rax said. That is the possible answer to all the odd behaviors we have witnessed.
I stared at the unmoving director. You're saying he's a clone?
I am unsure, but let us observe the facts. The director of the CAU immediately answered our call the instant we made it. In some ways, it almost seemed as if he was waiting for the call.
That would imply Baran, I said.
Let me finish my line of reasoning, Rax said testily. The director then came alone onto the guard ship with a bomb in his belly and a control device in his brain. He demanded that you join him on a space expedition to Mars and possibly beyond. None of those are the typical actions of the director of the CAU as we know him.
You got that right, I said. It's interesting that CAU grabbed Hap's tech. Hap had clones of Sergei. I frowned. How long does it take to grow a clone from infancy?
A clone is just like the real thing, Rax said. It should take many decades to mature a clone from a vat.
Unless Hap had some kind of quick-grow equipment, I said. Or unless CAU found a way to use the chronowarp on the clone. Do you think that's possible?
I am not familiar with all aspects of cloning, Rax said. Galactic law is quite severe regarding the use of clones. Thus...
But you think he's a clone, I said, pointing at the dead director.
At this point, I would give that a 97% probability,
Rax said. That high, huh? Do you think Baran sent him?
I do not, Rax said. Lord Baran desires your capture, not your elimination. I believe the clone was genuine in not knowing about the Hatter's assault. Thus, given the pseudo-director's requests, I'd say the CAU sent him.
Meaning the real director? I asked.
If he still maintains control of CAU,
Rax said.
Given Lord Baran's information about Debbie and you, he obviously had a source. CAU seems like the obvious source.
So then we're back to Baran having taken over CAU. I snapped my fingers. Maybe this was all a ruse to get us far away from Earth. Baran failed to capture me. Now he wants me out of the way so he can do whatever he's trying to do on Earth without our interference.
That is an interesting scenario with high probabilities of possibility,
Rax said. Right, I said, starting to mentally prepare for a mission. You'll have to teleport me to CAU headquarters.
Might I suggest an alternative method of discovery?
What's that? I asked.
Call CAU and see what transpires.
I thought about that as I went to the corpse and grabbed it by its feet. I began dragging the body from the piloting chamber.
I suggest you take the corpse to the stasis unit,
Rax said.
If we put it in stasis, that might keep the bomb from prematurely exploding aboard ship.
I pulled faster just in case the bomb was on some kind of timer. But I didn't drag the corpse to the stasis unit. Instead, I headed to the torpedo chamber.
Logan,
Rax said from an intra-ship comm,
you are going the wrong way.
I didn't answer. I didn't feel I had to since this was my ship.
This is a mistake,
Rax said 30 seconds later. I manipulated an inner torpedo hatch, shoved the corpse into the tube, and pressed the switch that slammed the hatch shut.
We may want the items for later study,
Rax said over the comm. I moved to a small control board, tapping it. I heard a clang and a whoosh, the sounds of the tube flooding.
Why the unnecessary haste?
Rax asked. I pressed the final switch and looked up at a tiny screen. The corpse ejected into the ocean from a torpedo tube. I turned and ran back to the piloting chamber. Jumping onto the seat, I pressed controls, moving us away as the body began to sink for the depths. Suddenly, the double helix cobalt bomb in its gut ignited, creating a white-hot flash in the water. The flash expanded and struck the guard ship. The entire vessel shuddered and rolled over. I grabbed the armrests of my piloting chair and barely kept myself from flying onto the ceiling, which was now below me. The ship kept moving, despite the groaning of metal twisting. Water began to gush into the piloting compartment. Rax! Rax! I shouted. The engine purred, control came back to the guard ship, and it righted itself. The seawater, however, continued gushing into the piloting chamber. What happened? I shouted.
The guard ship has been breached, Logan. The double helix cobalt bomb went off too close to the vessel. We have already begun to sink.
I activated the flight controls and began taking us higher. We'd gone down about 100 feet already. At that point, a secondary explosion within the ship caused the forward and upward motion to cease. Rax, I said.
We must abandon ship, Logan. We must do it at once, or we'll go too deep and I won't be able to transfer us out of here.
What? I shouted.
The engine is offline and water is filling several compartments,
Rax said.
We must abandon ship.
Chapter 9.